Okay. And I am going to talk about behavioral problems in children with special health care needs today. All right, so what we wanted to do with this study is first just kind of look at the prevalence and overall health problems related to children that that have special health care needs, and look at parental support and potential protective factors in terms of this population. One of the things that we do know, and there is some link between your presentation and mine, and so you'll hear me reference Julie, right? Julie's presentation, some of the things that she talked about will begin to be common in that theme. There's this notion of elevated stress that exists when you're caring for children that have special needs, and that stress can have some long-term impact with parents. There's additional stressors, depressive symptomology, poor mental health, and so all of these things essentially just kind of compound and add additional layers of complexity to parents. And so it's really important that we make sure that we're providing supportive services to children and families to reduce the level of stressors that they're experiencing. What we did in this study is use the National Survey of Children's Health, which was a national probability survey that examined the physical and mental health status, access to quality health care, as well as looking at information on children's family, neighborhood, and social context. This particular study identifies or defines children with special health care needs as those who have one or more chronic physical, developmental, behavioral, or emotional conditions for which they require an above routine type or amount of health and related services. And so recent data essentially shows that 14% to 19% of children in the United States have a special health care need, which roughly represents 1 in 5 households with children. So that kind of gives you some background, larger background, of this particular issue. And so when using this data, we were able to pull or extract roughly 5,500 children from the sample that presented with a diagnosis of depression, developmental disability, or autism, or a spectrum-related disorder for the sample. And so with that, our sample mean age was approximately 11 years of age. Roughly 37% were female. And you'll see, I'm going to continue to break down the results a little bit more, so I'll go over these and we'll get a little bit more detailed as we progress. But 73% of the sample was white, and 10% of the sample African American, 16% of the sample represented other racial groups. 2/3 of the sample reported as having behavioral problems, and overall 81% of the caregivers reported that they had social support. And so again, seeing the same theme related to the notion of social support and its importance. And so when we take those larger numbers, so I mentioned the 73% of respondents in the sample being white. So out of that, 17.4% reported having behavioral problems. Okay, so out of that 17% of the sample is now white with behavioral problems. Then we have 6% of those in the sample, so out of the 10% that are African American, 6% of those are now reporting behavioral problems. And that larger, the number of 16% that were of other racial groups, 5% of that group reports behavioral problems. Okay, and so these are all statistically significant. Then we wanted to look at the proportions of behavioral problems looking at the social environment, okay? And so within those that it reported behavioral problems, we saw that 25.2% reported difficulties, that they were having difficulties coping with parenthood. We see other larger numbers related to parental support, so 22% reporting parental support. We also see it drops down that only 9% is reporting having difficulties with problems paying bills. We see in terms of access, so thinking about access to recreational facilities, that 17.4% say that there's access to a recreational facility in their neighborhood, and 22.7% report that there are playgrounds in their neighborhood. Then we wanted to further look again at what health conditions. So looking at the proportion of those with behavioral problems, what does that look like in regards to the health conditions? And so looking at diabetes, out of that, this was one that those that reported diabetes were essentially less than 1% of that sample that reported having a behavioral problem and having being diagnosed with diabetes. I'm going to jump down to the bottom where we see depression, because depression, we see that 14% of those that report having behavioral problems also report having depression, and we see a similar number of 14.5 that have behavioral problems but do not have depression. And then we see for autism, 9% report having having autism and having a behavioral problem, but 19.5% report not having autism but having a behavioral problem. Okay, and so developmental delay, 15.5% report having a developmental delay as well as having a behavioral problem. Okay, and so that gives you the ability to look at the additional health conditions that the respondents are reporting in addition to the behavioral problems that they are presenting with. Okay. Then looking at this provides the odds of the behavioral problems when we look at them in contrast with sex, age, and insurance. And so the first represents females being normed against males. And so for this particular one, females were 44% less likely to report a behavioral problem in comparison to males. Children that were ages 12 to 17 were 38% less likely than those 11 and under to report behavioral problems. And then when we look over at the insurance, for insurance we have those with insurance being 2.27 times more likely to have behavioral problems than those without insurance. Okay, so very interesting. We'll talk a little bit more about those as we continue. Then looking again at this particular slide where we have race, and using whites as the reference group, we see that blacks are 55 times more likely to report having behavioral problems than whites. And we see for other ethnic groups, we see that they are 32% more likely to report having behavioral problems than whites. And one of the important things to look at with this particular slide is that although those groups are very similar in terms of the 55% and the 32%, only the black or African American demographic group is statistically significant. And so one of the other pieces that we observed is also looking at behavioral problems when we looked at children with depression. So there are higher odds being observed with children with depression, making them roughly two times more likely to have behavioral problems than children that don't have depression. And those with developmental delays are 60% more likely to have depression than behavioral problems than those without developmental delays. And when we have caregivers that are frustrated with the healthcare system, they're effectively three times more likely to have children that have behavioral problems than those that don't have children with behavioral problems. So obviously, you know, there's something there that's going on when we're working with people that experience frustration with our healthcare system. Okay. All right, and so I think this is kind of a good place to kind of go into some of the discussion piece. And so obviously there are some challenges that parents are going to face as a result of their children having healthcare challenges. And so some of those challenges obviously are going to be related to the stress. There's this potential issue related to marital discord. And so if you're in a home and your child is experiencing these high levels of stressors, and if social supports aren't in place, we don't have those resources in effect, you guys, you know, as parents, you're going at it with each other. And so we have to be mindful of what we do to help parents be able to work with each other and maintain that family unit together. So those are some of the challenges that they're going to face. The depressive symptomology, also the notion that parents' feelings, whether they're negative or positive, can have an impact on that child and can sometimes impact their externalizing of behaviors. So being very mindful of that. We also have to look at the supportive and protective factors. And so going back to a few of the resources and the results, And so one of the result slides looked at the playground piece. And so from a public health perspective, if there's a playground in a neighborhood and there's a healthcare facility in a neighborhood, then that provides a very clear opportunity for a family to say, okay, let's get out of the house, let's take advantage of this facility that's in our community and maybe, you know, go outside and let off some steam. So that's one way to look at this, you know, potential resource in a community if there's access there. The other opportunity comes in providing training for individuals that work within these community facilities and these neighborhood parks so that they're better trained and better equipped to be able to handle the challenges that some of our children with behavioral needs might possess, so that when they go to these facilities, they aren't told, no, you can't come back because we don't know how to handle you. So looking at that as an opportunity to better educate the community members so that children that experience these problems can actually receive support from their environments as well. We also have to look at making sure that our parental support as a protective factor is actually coupled with other protective factors so that that support really aligns within the family context, within the environment, the community, those resources, the school. So really looking at, you know, you talked about Bronfenbrenner and that, you know, total environment, and social workers really understand that environmental perspective. So making sure that all of those pieces really align to support that family and give them that parental support. And so when we also look at social supports, what does that really mean? So making sure, you know, talking to a family member and saying, you know, what does the social support look like for you? You know, okay, who are your friends that you can count on? And sometimes people don't realize that they have social support because they're used to doing things on their own, and they don't realize that, you know, when someone at their church or someone at their job says, you can call me, that they actually mean that you can call me. So sitting down with the person when you're working with them and helping them be able to say, okay, well, here's a list of people that I can call when things get a little rough with, you know, me and Sam. Okay, I know that my coworker said that she'd help me with this, so maybe I actually can call her and she'll come watch me for 10 minutes and I can go out and get a cup of coffee. So really helping them understand what social supports are. And, you know, and if you're working in a larger context, helping train people so that they understand what social support actually means. That it means, you know, the number of close friends and relatives, caregiver support, kinship care, positive interactions. How are those things measured? Affection. So being able to define what social support looks like. And also understanding that when caregivers report higher levels of social support, they're going to perceive a situation as being less stressful than someone who perceives to have low levels of self-support. So sometimes it comes down to the perception that someone may feel being supported. And so working to make sure that we're helping individuals be able to better perceive that they are indeed supported. And then the last thing that I want to talk about on this slide is, let me go back to also protective factors, keeping in mind the notion of resilience and being able to talk about resilience and use resilience as a protective factor, because that's something that we can use to help moderate chronic stress when people are having to take care of children that have developmental disabilities, that is one way to kind of mediate and manage those chronic stressors. And so in terms of opportunities to engage and support parents, one of the ways, when we looked at that, some of the ways that we can engage and support, assess, working with parents, counseling and education, those short-term pieces, the work that we do, making sure that we connect people, crisis management, case management, all of those things that are really important to our profession, being able to make sure that we do that. Looking at interventions that really provide support to parents, whether it's mindfulness, which can be very effective when we're looking at parental support, looking at psychosocial interventions that allow people to look at the cognitive behavioral aspects, and looking at that as a means of handling the stress and emotions so that the interventions aren't just focused on the emotional side and they're not just looking at emotionally focused coping strategies, but really looking at the total emotional, cognitive, behavioral focus within that. And just making sure that we're really providing that support, whether it's preventative or intervention focused, to help our families. And then in terms of recommendations, I just want to touch on a few and then I'll open it up for questions. In terms of practice, I would say that just making sure that as a practitioner, really looking at being able to identify from all levels, micro, meso, and macro, best practices for being able to work with families, and looking at interdisciplinary collaborations that will really allow us to build on the notion of a multidimensional framework and perspective for being able to work with communities. From a policy perspective, really supporting policy efforts, advocating, working with legislative groups. If you're connected with special care advocacy groups, making sure that you can connect key stakeholders to legislators, because sometimes they need to speak with people who are passionate, who are experiencing those things, to be able to have that perspective of what it's like to be a caregiver of a child who has special needs. And so sometimes having them speak directly with a parent, it gives them a different perspective, and they're really able to understand what it means and what this lived experience is like. Maybe they need to go and have a visit and go have coffee and sit at a parent's house and see what that's like to have a conversation with mom when child is running around and can't focus on that conversation because, you know, they're having to make modifications to make their house accommodatable for a child in that way. And so connecting them on a policy level with the people who are making policies that impact their daily lives. And from a research perspective, essentially doing what we're doing today, continuing to really identify things and putting the research behind what for many of us we know is common practice. We know that families need social supports. It's kind of a common sense practice because we're working directly with people, we see it, but oftentimes we need the research and we need the data to be able to support what it is that we're doing. So using the research to continue to do that and encouraging our clinicians that are out there in the field every day to do that, to have the research that drives what they do so that they're using the evidence-based practice and research-informed practice to really drive the back and forth of what needs to happen. And then also looking at continuing with any public awareness campaigns that continue to spread the messages that we need spread to encourage greater awareness about these issues. All right. And that's it for me. Any questions? The behavioral problems were defined by specific questions in the data set. And so the behavioral problems were, the sample asked specific questions and it asked about behavioral or, and the parents also had to answer these questions. So it was up to the parents to define, but behavioral or conduct problems. And so they asked specific to like oppositional defiant and things like that. Okay, what was your question?
As far as policy recommendations, are there any
I can't think of any specifically off the top of my head, but I can think and take your email and send you some if you like. So make sure I'll give you my card and you can follow back up with me. Okay. All right. Any others? I saw some head nods about the insurance question. Anybody want to? Okay. Okay. That's what I think. I mean, when we saw that, it I was a teacher before I became a social worker, and so I tell lots of people that my classroom was basically a behavioral modification. I mean, I taught, don't get me wrong, you know, I was a good teacher, I would like to think, but I was kind of the pre-stop before detention because I didn't like for people to write the kids up and all that stuff. And so I do think that some of that kind of very much has to do with being on the clinical side of social work, seeing you can either walk into a clinician's office and pay on a sliding scale or go get some insurance and actually be seen for free. And so if I'm a clinician and I know that you don't have the means to pay, I'm not going to attempt to charge you. I would say I would refer you somewhere else if I clearly identify that you have a problem. And this slide also includes all public health forms of insurance. So that's really important to note. So that's what I would think, that it's kind of one of those, since it includes the public health forms, which would cover behavioral health services, that some of that, whether they've gotten diagnosed outside of the classroom, it could be related to IEPs, all those other plans, things that happen outside externally, and then they're referred into the mental health care system, or parents that have identified and gone through a pediatrician, so all the multiple streams in which kids enter the behavioral health care system. Absolutely. So lots of different ways that it happens, but it was very, very interesting to just see the large number. So in some ways it's good because it shows that there is a utilization of services. You know, it's just we don't know how they all arrived in there. Any other questions? Okay, so you work with parents of adult children.
Yes, so their children are.
Yeah. And they're still primary caregivers. I think that there's a lot that could be taken from this, simply because they're still going to have the stressors that have compounded upon them. And in some ways, because their children are adults, there's an expectation or a, you've dealt with this for so long, you know, so some people understand and they'll say, okay, you need a break, but there are lots of people who would say, you've dealt with this for so long that I'm sure you've gotten it all figured out by now, so you don't need any help, you don't need any services. And so I would think that there remains a bigger issue around making sure that they know where they can find supportive services, because there is a significantly longer road that they're going to have ahead of them, particularly as they also age, because they have to think about what are the needs of their children once they're no longer there to provide care for them. So they have to begin making contingency plans about who cares for my child once I'm no longer able to care for my child. So that's a huge issue that they have to begin to think about, and so an additional stressor that then gets compounded on them in terms of their caregiving for themselves and their health. Anything else?